Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. Zoe is away this week, so you've got me bringing you the biggest week's stories. Coming up, should Britain pay reparations for its involvement in the slave trade? Well, a group of Caribbean nations at the Commonwealth of Governments Summit are preparing to defy the UK and agree plans to examine reparatory justice for its involvement in slavery. We'll discuss. We'll also look ahead as the government launches the Football Governance Bill in the House of Lords today, which aims to establish an independent football regulator. Should football be regulated? Like our water and gases? As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
The British policing model relies on mutual bonds of trust between the public and the police. For our policing model to work, it is essential that the police have the confidence of the communities they serve and that officers have the confidence they need to do their vital and often extremely difficult job of keeping us all safe.
Firearms officers facing trial over shooting suspects will receive anonymity up to the point of conviction, the Home Secretary has said. Yvette Cooper's announcement comes days after police officer Martin Blake was cleared of murdering Chris Cabba, who was shot in the head during a vehicle stop in Streatham, London in September 2022. Anonymity will stand on the rare instances firearms officers in England and Wales face criminal charges, Cooper said. She added that the Cabba case came against a backdrop of wider and long-standing concerns about police accountability, standards and confidence. Joining me to discuss this and some of the week's other big stories is Tom Scottson, political reporter for Politics Home. Thanks for joining me, Tom. Let's get into it first. The ins and outs of the controversial case following the shooting of Chris Cabba. We'll get to that shortly. But why do you think the Home Secretary has come to this decision so quickly?
Well, I think one of the main reasons is the political pressure that the Home Secretary has been put into. This is such a high-profile case that went on for many years. Of course, that Martin Blake was named. Many people protested about this and obviously didn't know the full details because there were reporting restrictions on Chris Cabba's background and a lot of the details that happened before the case. Now, of course, after the verdict was made, there's been a bounty put on Martin Blake, the police officer who shot Chris Cabba in the head, around £10,000 reward from gangsters who have set out who can for people on offer anyway, for people to kill this police officer. Now, I think it was probably right for Yvette Cooper to come out and make those claims and really put right what had happened, because this can't happen in the future. This can't be a precedent where people do not know necessarily the backstory and the background for cases like this to come up again.
We heard there in the clip the Home Secretary talk about the importance of needing the confidence of the community in policing. We have discussed policing on this show more than a few times, whether it's Sarah Everard, Chris Cabba, or the numerous cases and policy discussions around stop and search and other things. There's certainly a crisis in policing, but that doesn't seem to be reflected in our political system. How controversial is policing in the sort of political parties and the discussions in Westminster?
Well, I think the main thing about policing is that it used to be very much a difference where the Conservative Party were very much trusted on policing and Labour had to really win that trust, like a number of different issues. But I feel that now there's definitely been a cross-party consensus that they have to change the policing model and particularly the vetting processes. As you mentioned there before, there have been some horrific cases, particularly within the Metropolitan Police. We're talking about the death of Sarah Everard, for example, at a point in case. And of course, that there have been many cases that police officers had treated those in minority communities not like others as such. So there's definitely a trust issue that has happened. But I feel that this is a very unique case going on to the Chris Cabba case, that this was an officer who obviously shot. So Martin Blake shot Chris Cabba in the head, and that the background was so important to this. So, of course, that there is a different issue here, that there is a real crisis in policing and trust because of the number of issues. But I feel that the Home Secretary was probably right there to make a distinct case and change the law in this aspect.
And how one of the main questions I have is, how much is there a freedom in Westminster to talk about policing with an aim to actually fixing this when there is such a concern around how it plays out in the media with sort of Reform and Nigel Farage clipping at the heels, for example. So it becomes quite a performative discussion rather than a discussion about how we actually reach a resolution. Does that seem to be an issue the Home Secretary and the Labour Party has to deal with? Or do you think we are actually having a right sort of discussion as it pertains to policing?
I think at the moment, definitely this is, especially the one we're having in the real short term, that it seems that a very decent and good discussion. But I think the problem is, and I think this could reflect on a number of policy areas, is there are not many experts within government that understand policing. I mean, that many politicians and particularly cabinet ministers have very similar backgrounds. And those that don't really understand the criminal justice system, those who haven't been a police officer, never mind a firearms officer, it makes it very difficult to not stray into this performative debate. And I think you're right there that someone like Farage, this is catnip for him. This is catnip for people such as his supporters, that he can make these big claims that we have seen and really pander to his own supporters that want other policing. So I think we have a real crisis of experts within the Commons. And I think this is not just policing, but it extends wider than that.
Right. And let's move across to the Atlantic, across the Atlantic for our next story, and how Labour have somehow got themselves in hot water with the Americans. Prime Minister Keir Starmer has played down the significance of alleged interference by the Labour Party in the US presidential election. The row has sparked was sparked by a now deleted social media post from Labour's head of operations, Sophia Patel, that she had about 100 current and former party staff heading to America before polling day. Donald Trump's campaign has filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission in Washington, seeking an immediate investigation into what they called alleged blatant foreign interference. Sakir, who met Trump last month, said party staff going to the U.S. to campaign for the Democratic candidate Kamala Harris were volunteers doing it in their spare time and staying with other volunteers. Tom, is Trump's team right to call this electoral interference?
I think there are definitely a distinction to be made, because what my understanding is, and speaking to Labour staffers in Parliament this week, is that the 100 Labour staffers and the people that have already been out to the states to campaign for the Democrats have paid it off their own back. Now, that isn't a breach of electoral law. What would be a breach is if they overspent, if they spent over more than £1,000 from party donations to lend to the Democrat Party and spent more than £1,000 in transport costs. Yeah. Going over different states to campaign for it. So my understanding, it is not a break of electoral law in the United States. But I think one of the problems is that at the moment, this is a real breakdown in relations between the Labour Party and Donald Trump. Now, according to polls, it looks like Donald Trump could be the most likely candidate to win the presidential election. And I think it's very important, particularly over the next 4 or 5 years, as ever, for the UK government to have strong relations with the US administration. And that's looking to fray ever further if Labour staffers continue to go over there and campaign for the Democrats.
Yeah, and so, look, people crossing the Atlantic both ways to campaign in general elections has happened forever. People of both parties have gone over to campaign for the other two big parties. The question here is the optics of it, because it seems like it's sort of centrally organized. That's part of what the complaint has been. But more importantly, it's what you have covered. Donald Trump, at the best of times, let's say, takes things personally. And so if he were to win the presidential election, how much of an issue do you think this could be? And do you imagine Team Starmer and the Prime Minister's team around him have been working on overdrive to try and fix this quickly?
Starmer's team seem to have really looked at trying to repair relations with Donald Trump. When they had a press conference only a few weeks ago, Donald Trump described Keir Starmer as a very popular prime minister, which I think he'd have been very pleased to have heard those words from the former president.
Yeah, he doesn't hear that in this country, let alone from another leader.
I think he'd have been very happy with those remarks from the former president. The one thing I would bring up, though, I think it's an important point, is that anyone knows that Donald Trump is very fickle. He's very disorganized. He's one of those that a president that will change his mind very quickly. We've seen even with other foreign leaders where he got on very well with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. And as soon as Netanyahu congratulated Joe Biden on his win, started swearing about him and denouncing him in public. And now they seem best of friends again. So it's a kind of relationship I could see that at the moment it looks very hot. Things look very explosive. But when Trump, if he wins the election, gets into office, then there's going to have to be a practical politics element where he's just going to have to get on with Starmer in some form. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, the optics do not look good.
Yeah, and you add this to the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, who in the past has previously called Mr. Trump a neo-Nazi sympathizing sociopath. So you add that on top of what's happened recently. Is there a chance that the personal aspects of this relationship could see a breakdown of some significant sort between the United States and the United Kingdom?
I think it's going to be, with two administrations, probably the most polar opposite views we've ever seen. Of course, we've seen one where we've had a Labour government and a Republican administration in the US. We saw a Bush and Blair head of state. But however, that was one of those that they got on very well, famously, throughout the 8 years that Bush was president. However, I think of different personalities. I mean, you'd want to be a fly on the wall in a conversation with Donald Trump and Keir Starmer. You couldn't think of two very different people. So I think of all times in political history, this is probably going to be the two polar opposite leaders of each country. And I think that could cause problems. But the real politic element of this is that these are two countries that are very close together militarily and economically. They will have to form some relationship somehow.
Yeah, and we'll see if Donald Trump even wins that next election. The bookies do have him as favourites, and so do the polls. Keep an eye on my Twitter. I'm dropping my map of predictions. I've got Kamala Harris winning it, and all coming down to Pennsylvania. So we'll see that. We'll continue to talk about that in the coming weeks. Back home, it's less than a week to go before Labour's first budget in more than 14 years.
Next week, I'll be presenting this new government's first budget to deliver on our promise of change. I'm going to be honest about the scale of the challenge that we inherited. A decade of sluggish economic growth, deteriorating public services, and a £22 billion black hole in the public finances. But we must not be held back by the past, and instead we should look to the opportunities of the future. That's why the budget next week will fix the foundation so that we can deliver that change. No return to austerity, but a credible, honest plan for the future. We will protect working people, and we will begin to fix our public services, particularly our NHS, so people get the treatment that they need when they need it. And we will invest in our country's future so we can rebuild Britain.
I was 16 years old the last time we had a Labour budget, and, well, we've got another one after 14 years, and what should we expect? It's Labour's first big moment since their election win more than 100 days ago. There's been rumours about an increase to employer national insurance, murmurs that loopholes could be closed around inheritance tax, whispers that HS2 will be extended further than Birmingham and to London Euston, and suggestions that other taxes might be raised. But perhaps, unusually, nobody truly knows what's going to be announced yet. Tom, what are your predictions?
I mean, if it makes you feel any older, I think I was about 9 or 10 in the last Labour budget, so it was a very...
You did not need to make me feel old.
but I think what we're largely expecting is some spending cuts, which will have to happen, but I think largely it will be tax rises. I think the two things that I would mainly predict are an extension of, or an increase in, alcohol duty and fuel duty. They've been frozen for many years now, and that seems the easy ground for Labour to make some more money and increase the health of the public coffers. I'd also expect to see changes on capital gains tax and what you muted there about inheritance tax. Again, that this can easily feed into Labour's line about recreating and changing innovation, intergenerational injustice. I think it's an important part of Labour's messaging. But for a large part, I think there will be tax rises, particularly as their main strategy will be to improve the health of Britain's public services.
Labour made quite a big deal about no tax rises during the general election. Do you think this could hurt them in the polls?
In the short term, for sure, particularly with many of the voters that it won in, particularly seats maybe in the north and the southeast, that there's those seats that it never won before, and they've been true blue for a while. But I feel that we've got a long time for this Labour government. It's a huge majority. There was a real appetite for change in the country, and you could tell that from travelling across the general election campaign, whether it had been in seats that were marginal throughout the 2010s all the way to 2024, or those seats that have been Tory for decades. However, if there is no uptick in growth and people do not feel that they are wealthier in a few years' time, I think that will be big trouble for the Labour Party.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in Labour who feel like there's a long way to go, and so there's no need to panic on the polls quite yet. But the worry is also that people could make their minds up very early, like they did with Rishi, and there's nothing you can really do from then on to change those views. There was a huge appetite for change, but I think both polls and the feeling on the country feels like, even though there was a huge appetite for change, there wasn't a huge appetite for Labour, or let's call it enthusiasm for Labour. And one of the criticisms has been, since the election, that Labour's talked down too much the country, the economy, it's too much doom and gloom. And again, it kind of sounds, in that clip we just played of Rachel Reeves, that again, it's a little bit down and doom and gloom. Do you think Labour's message needs to be slightly more positive, even if they're having to take tough decisions?
I think purposely they've made it sound pretty negative so far, so they can really show the difference between the new administration and the Conservative one of the last 14 years. I do think they probably have overblown it slightly, and I think that's definitely fed into the more negative headlines we've seen, whether it's been about cutting winter fuel allowance or the potential tax rises and national insurance hike for employers that have been rumoured. However, I feel that the strategy, and this is my sense, is that by the end of this parliament and towards the next general election, they'll be able to show the differences between their messaging then and what they've been saying now, so they can easily compare it to the public, maybe on election leaflets and on the doorstep, that, and try and convince them anyhow, however the economy is doing, that they are better now in the future than they are and were previously at the last parliament.
And lastly, Tom, do you think there could be any surprises? Do chancellors usually keep a couple of things up their sleeve for on the day to kind of grab the headlines? Or do we pretty much know what's going to come?
They sometimes do. But the last big surprise we had was in the mini budget when there was the cut to the top rate of tax. And that did not and that definitely put them to the worst defeat they've ever had at the last election, or definitely contributed to it. So I would be surprised if there was anything major, such as a huge tax cut. But you never know in politics.
Right. Thank you so much. That was Tom Scottson, political reporter for Politics Home, joining us this week for The Week Unwrapped. Coming up, should Britain give reparations to Caribbean countries for its involvement in the slave trade? The Prime Minister doesn't want to have that conversation, batting it down when speaking to journalists at the Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit. But a host of Caribbean nations are not letting the issue go. We'll speak to somebody who's paying out of his own pocket because of his family's link to slavery. That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
You're listening to Fubar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah.
strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be like. They see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuck boy, like, lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me, and I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, tell us a little bit more.
You wanna go there?
Yeah, we're going there. Access all areas, mate.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. Now, Commonwealth heads of government are preparing to defy the United Kingdom and agree plans to examine reparatory justice for the transatlantic slave trade. Downing Street insists the issue is not on the agenda for the summit of 56 Commonwealth countries, which begins in the Pacific Island nation of Samoa tomorrow. But diplomatic sources said officials will negotiate an agreement to conduct further research and begin a meaningful conversation about an issue which could potentially leave the UK owing not billions, but trillions of pounds in reparations. Well, earlier, I spoke to John Dower, a reparations campaigner and co-founder of the campaign group Heirs of Slavery, about why the conversation around slavery reparation needs to be had. Well, joining me now, I have John Dower, a reparations campaigner and co-founder of the campaign group Heirs of Slavery. John, thank you so much for joining us. I'm first going to ask you a little bit about the Trevelyan family, who saw publicly that they had been involved in more than 1,000 enslaved Africans, visited the Caribbean, apologized and paid reparations. Can you give our audiences a little bit of background of the journey that that took and what the Trevelyan family's decision was and what has happened since?
Thanks, Ali. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And it's great to be able to talk to your listeners and looks like viewers as well, given the fact I'm on camera. So 2016, I read an article in The Guardian by David Oldeshoga, the great black historian, who's really been doing some really groundbreaking work in terms of black history in the UK. And he said, if you're a middle-class person, if you're descended from landed gentry, aristocracy, basically if you are doing okay, and you might see yourself as middle class, it's worth looking on the Legacies of Slavery database, which has been put together by University of College London. I think it had been digitized in 2014. So they essentially are all the records of the names of the enslaved and the families that received so-called compensation for the ownership of the ownership is also in inverted commas of the enslaved in 1834. So I went onto that database with some trepidation because I thought maybe my family, which I've always sort of heard is a very public-facing, very philanthropic, public-spirited family. Always my ancestors told me that we were on the side of the abolitionists if they ever talked about transatlantic trafficked enslaved people, trade of those people. And I put the word Trevelyan in, and lo and behold, up came six names and six plantations in Grenada, which they had part ownership of. And my world just kind of exploded because I suddenly realised I was not the person I thought I had been. And so that's where the journey started. I would encourage anybody listening who believes potentially their family might have been involved to go on that database because they might be in for a surprise.
John, can I stop you right there before you move to the next bit, which we're all really interested about? I want to know the personal impact of that, because so much of what I hear, I've talked about reparations on different political programs for a long time now, and I continuously hear, what's it got to do with us if our great-great-grandparents did something? But it seems like it had a profound personal impact on you finding out that your family had been involved in this. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, my great-grandfather, Charles Phillips Trevelyan, was in the Labour Party in the first cabinet in early 1920s, and he was Minister for Education. And the story I was always told by my family was that we did good things. You know, my grandmother was on the youth hostels board. My grandfather did important things in terms of introducing a white paper to set up the national parks. I'm just giving you an illustration. This is a family that I thought we were kind of doing. We were what you might call a good family.
Yeah, the story you told yourselves, the story that was told at the dinner table.
So when I discovered that we were something different, that we had derived income and my ancestors had basically hidden that under the carpet, I just realised that my family, my ancestors had been hypocrites, and I went on I guess you might call it a crusade, but it's been a very profound experience for me to realize I'm actually not who I thought I was, i.e. I am a descendant of people that owned enslaved people, and that I am, therefore, I have derived privilege from that. And I think that's what's really, really shocked me and has taken me on this journey.
And then what decisions did you guys make coming out of that?
So it took around 7 years. We didn't really coalesce until 2022. The things that happened in between were the Colston statue was knocked down, George Floyd was murdered, Black Lives Matter marches went on. We were in the middle of the pandemic. A lot of my family started to watch the telly and realised that racism was alive and kicking. I mean, I knew that, but I think many of them were not necessarily convinced of the severity of the situation. And that then galvanised us to start having Zoom meetings as a family and then put together an apology letter, which we delivered to the people of Grenada in February 2023.
Mm-hmm. And what about our reparations? And was any payments made or what happened?
Yes. So we offered at the time £100,000, which we essentially said to the Grenadian government, what would you like to do with this? And we've subsequently set up a charity called the Trevelyan Education Charity, Grenada Education Charity, which is funding programs, education programs in Grenada.
Mm-hmm. And so, John, this brings us to where we are now, because the conversation nationally happening now, particularly with the conference happening, I think it's in Samoa, in the islands of Samoa, and post-BLM and other things, there's huge conversations around reparations. Your family recognized the part that they played in one of the greatest crimes in human history in the slave trade, and have made steps towards both apology and reparations. Our government is refusing to do that. We've heard Keir Starmer say he kind of wants to look forward, doesn't want to look back, has ruled out reparations, has ruled out a formal apology. Why is an individual family able to do that, but a government isn't?
Well, that's a big question. And actually, interestingly, it sounds as though the government are beginning to cave a little bit in that they've just announced that they might talk about non-financial help. Why is it? Well, a family, I suppose, is a smaller unit with less responsibility. The government is a massive organisation, obviously, and it's a very poignant and significant act for it to make an apology as we did. But I would argue that make an apology they must, because for too long the descendants of the enslaved have been ignored. They've been calling for justice. They've been treated appallingly, and I think the government need to start to talk to them. Now, one of the really important things to establish here is that reparations don't automatically equals money.
Uh-huh.
It starts with an apology. It starts with a recognition that a wound was caused and the responsibility lies with the government and the royal family, particularly because they are the organisations that sanction so much of this.
Yeah, I think so. The conversation we always hear is it's so far long away, and why does this generation pay for the past's mistakes? So my view is, and agree or disagree with me, your family have kind of taken the journey that I think is natural for a moral human being to take, which is, look, our country is we're the sixth largest economy in the world, one of the richest nations in the world. That's undoubtedly due to empire and colonialism and slavery. And so we continue to benefit from that crime, and so should make mend in any way that we can, whether it's an apology, debt cancellation, or reparations. That's the journey your family has taken on. The country should surely take the same journey.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about it. And to be frank, I think we are getting to a stage now, particularly with the Commonwealth countries, and this being the first significant meeting that the King's had with the Commonwealth since coming on the throne. I think this is going to be a really big moment. And we're at this moment in time because black reparationists have been campaigning for a long time. If you go back in the last 20, 30 years, apartheid was ended. This the very important database, which I think is very significant, that I referred to earlier on, has proved beyond doubt people's and families and individuals and institutions' involvement in the trade. And the king has said himself, for example, that he's going to put money into research and he's going to come out with the findings, I think, next year. I mean, it really isn't that complicated for him to go back and actually see the reality of the royal family's involvement. I think the time has come. We are at a real important moment, and I think our families' apology and the setting up of the organisation, which we did, which you mentioned earlier on, Heirs of Slavery, which we did just before the king came on the throne, I think we're just a small part of that movement. But that movement goes back a long way.
Yeah, and I think it's important to also note that there are British citizens today in this country who have been affected by it. I mean, my in-laws came on Windrush, for example, who have been sort of involved in this whole journey. John, I wonder if I can ask you, given that we've got a much younger audience here, it's undoubted, I think, that this generation is far more alive and conscious of the history of the country and our role in empire, colonialism and slavery than any other. How much does the government and the monarchy risk alienating itself from a younger generation if it ignores this central issue?
Hugely, I say. I mean, look, I have great hopes for the younger generation, and my generation, I think, is only just waking up, because we just realised the truth of this. But I really, my hopes lie with the younger generation. I think there is a great danger of the government alienating them if they don't engage with this properly. I saw some figures that 60% of this country believe that we should engage in some kind of reparative justice, and that I think is probably on the low side. Mm-hmm. I think really, if you really talk to people about what should be done, I think there is a majority of people who believe this, and I think the government is really in danger.
Yeah. And like you said, it doesn't necessarily mean trillions of pounds in money per se, although it could include that. But I am looking in front of me at the CARICOM 10-point plan for reparatory justice. That's a hard word to say, which includes things like formal apology. It does include reparations, but it also includes things like cultural institutions, public health, psychological rehabilitation, as well as debt cancellation, which is a huge part. So the last question I want to ask you, I know a lot of people in the Labour Party and the Prime Minister's team do listen to this programme and watch the programme. I'm not sure if the King does. If King Charles is listening, do drop me a WhatsApp. But speaking directly to them, your family has gone on a very personal journey and made a very, very significant choice. What choice should the government and the United Kingdom as a country be making if you're speaking to them directly?
I think they need to engage with CARICOM, and the first thing they need to do is actually sit down and meet with them. And then they need to apologise. And that apology needs to be heartfelt, and it needs to recognise the wound that was created. And I think they then need to also talk to the diaspora in the UK. And ideally, they'd also be talking to the African Union and also, of course, all the Commonwealth countries that are asking for this. So I think what they need to do is engage in conversation to start with and realise the depth of pain that has been caused, apologise, and then start to get into constructive conversation around making things better, i.e. trying to make that wound heal in some kind of way.
Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm getting from what you have said today is that this isn't yesterday's problem. It's very much a live issue today, and as we see very much today in the news.
One of the quotes from PJ Patterson, who was a previous Prime Minister of Jamaica, he said, "The same winds that blew the ships to the Caribbean is blowing climate change to us." So all of that exploited labour and resources that was taken from the Caribbean, that built the Industrial Revolution, that built Britain, that created the Industrial Revolution, which has now polluted the world and created climate change, is now destroying the Caribbean. So the reparations is a really important issue, but climate change is also a huge issue. Both of these things, in a way, go in tandem.
I couldn't have thought of a better way to end the interview. Thank you so much. That was John Dower, a reparations campaigner and co-founder of the campaign group Heirs of Slavery. John, thank you so much for joining us.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Well, we've just heard from John Dower there. Coming up, the government have relaunched the Football Governance Bill in the House of Lords today, which will attempt to establish an independent regulator for football in England. But does football need to be regulated? I finally get to talk about football on the show. Those of you who know me will know how excited I am. And you don't understand how happy that makes me. We've got all of that and more coming up next.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be like. They see like the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be like this, like serious, like fuck boy, like laugh. You know what I mean? And then they meet me. And I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some free videos come through.
Oh, so tell us a little bit more.
You
no,
go, you go there.
Yeah, we're going there. Access all areas, mate.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. Now, the government has relaunched the Football Governance Bill in the House of Lords today with a number of changes to the initial bill first launched in March. The original bill failed to progress through Parliament before July's general election, but has now been brought back by the Labour government. The bill will establish an independent football regulator with the ability to implement a backstop measure which could be used should the Premier League and the EFL not find agreement over funding. The regulator will also be fully independent and will no longer be obliged to consider foreign policy and trade when ruling on who can own a football club. Well, joining us to discuss this and more is Araman Banerjee, head of football governance at consultancy firm Lane, Clark and Peacock. Araman, thank you so much for joining us. Can I first ask you, who currently regulates football in this country?
Well, first of all, Ali, thank you for having me on. That is a big question because technically we already do have a regulator for football, for English football in the form of the Football Association. That is traditionally its role. And in theory and on paper, that is still the role of the FA. However, what we've seen since the formation of the Premier League is that over the last 30 odd years, that the Football Association has slowly lost its grip on the regulation of football, and that's been usurped. That power has been usurped by the Premier League. So what you get then is a situation where the tail wags the dog and the Premier League begins to regulate football in the interests of its 20 members rather than in the interests of the wider game. Now, that becomes increasingly problematic when you think about within the Premier League at the moment. We have a very fractionalized system, lots of different groups, lots of different cliques there. So even within the body that has taken power, you have different objectives. And that is why we reach a situation where the governance systems are so poor in this country when it comes to football. And that's when you get things like a European Super League. That's when you get the slew of administrations that we've seen amongst football clubs in recent years. And that's why there have been calls for this independent regulator to be introduced.
And so what would this new football governance bill hope to achieve? Is it about bringing this independent regulator to kind of put a check on particularly the Premier League? Because if we're all honest, this all came out of the European Super League. That's what reignited all of this. Is the aim to kind of put a final stopgap measure in case things like the Super League happen again? What's the hope? What's the aim? What's the objective?
Yeah, so that is one of the objectives, and that is very clearly outlined both in the previous bill under the Conservative government and under the Labour government, that there is a block on breakaway competitions and English clubs joining breakaway competitions. The other key objective is, of course, to stop the culture of financial unsustainability that currently exists within English football. What you have are English football clubs, cornerstones of local communities, real community assets, being run into the ground, being run into administration, and in very tragic cases, liquidation as well. And the aim of this regulator is to shore that up and to ensure that we have a culture of financial sustainability across the board, which means that those sorts of scenarios are no longer the case, and we are not gambling anymore with the future of community assets in the form of football clubs. In order to do that, a number of regulations have been proposed that will be implemented by this regulator when it comes in, everything from new corporate governance codes to new checks on owners and directors and annual financial and strategic reports that will have to be submitted to this regulator. And the hope is with that addition in terms of red tape, we will be able to have a more financially solvent industry overall.
So I'm really glad you spoke about football clubs as community assets, because that at my heart is, I think, fundamental to our game, to the league and to this country. Football clubs all across the country are such important community assets, cultural assets. They're some of the most important part of people's lives. I think sometimes people who aren't football fans don't understand just how important people's football teams are to them. And there are a huge amount of risks that didn't exist 20 years ago that exist today. Things like sports washing, foreign state ownership of football clubs, things like what's being called the Americanization of football, which is a direct challenge to the football pyramid and to the competitiveness of our league. Are these things that this regulator and this bill can tackle, or is that beyond the scope?
Well, no, particularly with regards to sports washing. Under the previous bill, what we saw was that when a new owner or director came in to try and buy a football club, that it could be sold to someone with potentially strong state links, which is obviously what's happened in the past with Newcastle United and Manchester City, because the regulator would have to take into account state and foreign policy objectives when deciding whether or not to block a move.
So, yeah, and so example, if we use Newcastle as an example here, I think you might have just been about to go into it. There were rumours and discussions that the government at the time picked up the phone and made phone calls and discussions based on the government at the time's foreign policy and trade objectives. That will no longer be the case.
No, under this new bill, it will no longer be the case. That is one of the changes that have come under this new bill, as you quite correctly allude to. And I don't think these are rumours anymore. Boris Johnson was told that the trading relationship between Britain and Saudi Arabia would suffer if the Premier League were not, if the Premier League did not approve the bid for Newcastle United. And so it's not to say that we won't still have state ownership and we won't still have sports washing, but on a case-by-case basis, when the regulator makes a decision on whether an owner is appropriate or not to take over an English community asset, it will no longer have to take into consideration the foreign and trade policy objectives that have, I think, to the detriment of the game, been analysed in the past as part of that process.
Mm-hmm. And would this new regulator be able to put a foot down and stop a European football, a European Super League from happening in the future? Because we, you know, when the Super League happened, there was huge amounts of backlash and fan protests, and clubs had to end up apologizing to fans and rowing back. But there are still rumors and murmurs that this idea continues to be on the table. Certainly, if Florentino Perez has anything to do with it, my club's owners, the Glazers, who still hang around like a bad smell, they, if they have anything to do with it, they'll want to see it. So, would this regulator be able to stop a European Super League?
So it wouldn't be able to stop the concept of a European Super League, because that can exist, of course, outside Britain. What it would be able to do, and what it has done successfully in this legislation, is place a block on English clubs being able to join that Super League. That is very clear in the legislation. That is something that has been at the core of this process of reform. And as you say, a lot of this was stimulated from the European Super League arising in 2021. And so, no, it wouldn't be able to stop the idea of a European Super League. If Florentino Perez wants to go on and form one, then he's very welcome to try.
Yeah.
But what we can say is that English clubs will not be involved.
And that's, I think that'll be good news to a lot of football fans out there. How have the Premier League reacted to this?
So that's a very interesting question. The Premier League have been notoriously cool about this since it was proposed, since the idea of a regulator was proposed. Naturally, having accrued so much authority and power over the last 30 years, it doesn't readily want to give that up to a new independent regulator. We've seen a statement from them today, which is very much still in line with what they've said previously, that perhaps there are elements of this that the Premier League could support, but fundamentally they have gross concerns is about what this could do to the wider football industry. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the EFL have been very supportive of this, and Rick Parry, chairman of the EFL, has stated this morning how supportive he is of this legislation. So we've really got a friction between those two bodies at the moment.
But that exists naturally. Well, first of all, anytime you regulate any industry, the group that has the power existently always has grave concerns about power being taken away from them. But I think what you've just mentioned is a good indicator to the layman who might not understand, in terms of the tension between the top 20 teams, for example, in the English football pyramid, really the top six or eight, if we're honest, mm-hmm. and the other 3,000, for example, who take all of the brunt of it. So this could be said, as a football regulator, could be in support to empower the bottom half of the pyramid, or the bottom 90% of the pyramid, as opposed to the top 10%. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is certainly what the EFL are trying to angle it towards, and what the key to that is going to be the financial redistribution package between the Premier League and the EFL, which the regulator will, we know today, still have backstop powers to enforce a deal if those two organisations, mm-hmm. the Premier League and the EFL, fail to agree. Now, the significant change that comes out of today's bill is the EFL have been handed a massively advantageous bargaining chip in regards to the fact that when assessing any potential deal, the regulator will be able to take into account all financial redistribution measures. That includes parachute payments. So in theory, what that means is the regulator will be able to impose a watering down, a dilution, or in an extreme case, an abolition of parachute payments, which the Premier League have been fighting to keep and which the EFL have been fighting to abolish. And mm-hmm. that, in a negotiation between the Premier League and the EFL, naturally gives the EFL a massively enormous advantage in that bargain. And so that's why I think we're seeing that very positive reaction coming out of EFL HQ today.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, the parachute payment is the money that clubs get as they move from one league to another. Last question, Aramin, if I may, very quickly, because we don't have that much time. Who could this regulator be? Because presumably it'll be an individual. Will it be set by government?
So there is already an interim chief operating officer. We know that the regulator will have about 100 people, I think, or thereabouts, working for it. It'll be based out of Manchester. Currently, we don't have an inclination about who specifically it'll be. It'll naturally be a high-ranking executive, either from the football industry, or I wouldn't rule out from another industry such as the legal world. Yeah. But we wait to see on the confirmation of who that will be.
Yeah, so what you're telling me is your phone lines are open in case they want to ring you.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. That was brilliant. That was Aramin Banerjee, Head of Football Governance at the consultancy firm Lane, Clark and Peacock.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Well, there you have it. That was Aramin Banerjee, who is the Head of Football Governance at consultancy firm Lane, Clark and Peacock, who gave us a really interesting insight into this potential football regulator. Now, for those of you who are listening who are not football fans, who are listening for the politics element of the show, let me tell you why this is important for you and for the politics of our country. Because the football clubs that we talk about are not just sort of things that you see on TV or things that people go and watch on Saturdays and Sundays. They're community assets to each to people all around the country. And we're not just talking about the big clubs, the Manchester Uniteds of the world. We're not even talking about the smaller clubs that you might know of, things like Arsenal and Manchester City and Liverpool Football Club, for example. But there are community asset clubs all across the country that play an integral role into what people's kids do on a Saturday and a Sunday. They do food banks, they run community centres, arts and crafts centres, and all these kind of things that are interwoven into community relations and the lives of everyday people. And these clubs are at real risk, because if the money continues as it has done over the many years in the past to essentially be sucked upwards, then what we will continue to see, what we will see, is football clubs going out of business all across the country. Let's use London as an example. London currently has 92 professional football clubs in our city. That's a lot, right? But these football clubs will be having enormous impacts, all 92 of them, on local people all across London. And if we only prioritise Chelsea, Arsenal, Fulham, Brentford, Tottenham, all these clubs that I'm thinking off the top of my head that currently sit in the Premier League, and we see smaller clubs going out of business, even if they have huge historic ties, places like QPR, for example, then what you see is essentially community assets being ripped away from the country. It's no different to youth clubs being closed all around the country, or community arts centres and community hubs and libraries being closed. These are the same sort of assets. Just because they have sport and a specific sport as an integral part of that doesn't mean that those things get ripped away. That's number one. The second part is these football clubs are also huge cultural institutions and have enormous power for the United Kingdom. It's what we often call soft power. So people all across the world associate our country often in a positive sense when it comes to football. Because if you go to countries in Asia, in Africa, in South America, you'll see Man United shirts, you'll see Arsenal shirts, you'll see Chelsea shirts, you'll see Liverpool shirts. And so that sort of cultural export is hugely important to our country. And things like the European Super League are a direct attack on that cultural export. So it only makes sense that, like every other industry we have in this country, particularly ones that have such cultural impacts, such significance to our communities, to our politics, to our nation's view outside the world, but also to the people who support and follow these football clubs, that there be a stopgap, that there be a regulator, and the government has in some way the ability to step in when out-and-out villains like the Glazer family attempt to change the way that the football pyramid system works in what I call the Americanization of football, which is getting rid of the competitiveness of our football where no one can get relegated and everyone, the top teams always have a say and continue to operate at the very top level. Or sports washing and state ownership, where community assets in Manchester or in Newcastle, those two teams, Manchester City and Newcastle, which have been at the front of the news, are then owned by foreign states, states like United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia, allegedly are centrally linked to the ownership of Newcastle. And so it goes without saying that these things should absolutely be regulated, and there should be a way for government, for the country to step in when these football clubs try and break away from our league or create a European Super League, to say no, enough is enough. And that is what Ahriman Banerjee was talking about with us there. That's it from Politics Uncensored today. I finally got to talk about football, so I hope everyone is happy. I can certainly say that this year has been made for me. Join me and Zoe next week. Next week, we're on a Wednesday. We'll be talking more about that, but there will be a Politics Uncensored next week at 5 p.m. on a Thursday to unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK. If you've missed any of today's show, you can go back and listen and catch up at foobarradio.com. Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored on Foobar Radio.